So I just wanted to remind the audience here that we're going to go ahead and go into our Q&A mode. And so bear with me while I swap out the live screen. And I'll just remind the audience that you have access to a Q&A panel. If you haven't opened it up, look in the upper right of your screen for a small Q&A icon. You'll be able to click that out, and a window will pop out on the right side. You can be privately sending in comments and questions using that space. If you have no questions at this time, you can also enter that in as a message and send it. If you've already entered a question, I have them in the queue, and I'm going to start with those. And again, I'll just remind everyone, keep those questions coming on in, and we'll try to get through as many as we can in the time that we have remaining today. So this very first question goes back to what you all started with. Actually, a few people have asked for you to just clarify that the U.S. is not party to the Basel Convention or treaty. And then I have a follow-on, depending on the answer to that.
Yeah, thanks. There are certain provisions in the Basel Convention Treaty that you have to have the legal authority to implement those provisions in order to ratify the convention and become a member of the Basel Convention. Now, the U.S. is a signatory, and for those of us in the international world, you know, we know what that means. It sounds more significant than it really is. And actually, being a signatory doesn't mean much. It just means that you're agreeing to the text that was negotiated. And if you've been involved in negotiations, that'll go to 1 or 2 a.m. in the morning, and there's pieces of paper everywhere and printouts, and you think you know what you agreed to, but you're not entirely sure. Well, the international organization types it all up and puts it all together. And basically, when you sign, you're saying, yes, that's the text I agreed to. What's much more important is called ratification, and that's how you become a party. And because you need to have legal authority to implement all the provisions of the treaty to ratify, we have not been able to do that. We have the legal authority for most of the Basel provisions, but there's a few that we don't have the legal authority for. One is there's certain wastes that are Basel-covered wastes that we don't regulate at the federal level that we would need to be able to require prior notice and consent for exports for those wastes. And an example is medical waste. We would need to be able to require prior notice and consent for medical waste for us to be a party, and we don't regulate medical waste at the federal level. So that keeps us from being a party. Now, the way medical waste is regulated domestically would not change. This would just, you know, if we got the legal authority, became a Basel party, it would just apply to imports and exports. So that's an example. There are certain things that, certain wastes that are Basel covered waste that we would need to be able to cover that we're not able to. Another example is what's called returns. You know, if there's sometimes a waste is shipped and it's not what the receiving facility thought they were going to get. And so, you know, EPA under that scenario would need to be able to force the return of that shipment. In practice, it's often alternative management in another country or another facility. It wouldn't necessarily be brought back to the U.S., but we don't have that legal authority. You know, and then the third gap in our legal authority is on transit notices. So under Basel, if you're sending, you know, Basel covered scrap or waste through another country, then you're required to send a transit notice to that country and get a consent. I had talked to you earlier about transit countries. And under RCRA, the US law, we can only require a transit notice if there's an import or an export. Well, it sounds like we're covered. We're not. And the reason we're not is because we have hazardous waste coming from Alaska that gets trucked through Canada to the US for the lower 48 states for management. It's not an import or an export. It's a US to US shipment, but yet it goes through another country. So under Basel, because it goes through another country, we have to do a transit notice. But under RCRA, we don't have the legal authority to require transit notice unless it's an import or an export, we can only require transit notice if it's an import or an export, which in Alaska, the lower 48 shipment is not. So that's the three legislative gaps. So we need to have those legislative gaps filled before we're in a position to ratify the Basel Convention. Thanks.
Thank you. And just a follow-on question, has the U.S.'s role in the convention changed at any point in time?
So we've never been a party. We've never ratified. We've never had the legal authority. So we've always been the official status for somebody who's not a party who participates in decisions on the international implementation of Basel as an observer. Leah mentioned that earlier. So we've always been an observer in international meetings, at Basel meetings where they talk about how to implement Basel.
All right. A number of people have asked if you could repeat when the changes will, quote, go live.
Yeah, so it's January 1st, 2021. And that's the changes for both Basel and OECD. The OECD, because it was harmonized with Basel, has their changes go into effect at the same time. So January 1st, 2021.
Okay. Now we have questions about the applicability in some background in determining this new rule. So one of the attendees wanted to know if you could talk about the metrics for deciding that non-hazardous plastic scrap does not meet or need requirements for imported export. They're just wondering if you could talk from an economic or environmental perspective.
So let me start on that and I'll hand it over to Leah. So I think unfortunately we don't really have metrics, except for the Basel B3011 listing where you can have PE and PPE and PET, et cetera, together. And then you're not a Basel covered waste. You don't have to do notice and consent. Once you get beyond that, it starts getting fairly nebulous, and you've got all those terms that Leah talked about that have not yet been defined in terms of what they mean. So we're not really at a point of having metrics, and one of the things that to keep in mind is usually in Basel, when you have a change like the plastic scrap amendments, the plastic scrap waste listing changes, it happens over a series of Basel meetings over 2 or 3 years. So those terms get defined along the way, or they're mostly defined. People have a pretty good grasp of them. People were so concerned, Basel countries were so concerned about marine litter that they drove through the plastic scrap changes in one Basel meeting. That's never happened before. While some countries are happy about that in terms of trying to address marine litter, it leaves us with this unfortunate circumstance of having a lot of undefined terms that will need to be defined in the next several years. So, Leah, is there anything you want to add to that?
I think that is basically it. I mean, the terms to most pay attention to in that B3011 listing are, almost exclusively. So basically, plastic scrap really needs to be pre-sorted on the front end before export so that it would be considered almost exclusively consisting of one of the three categories I talked about, so either a non-halogenated polymer, which are the common plastic recyclables that are used in, household products and drinking water bottles and that kind of thing, or almost exclusively of, one thermoset plastic, so the resins, epoxy resins, that's what's used in the hard plastics, or a limited number of the fluorinated polymers. And then the other term is almost free from contamination and from other wastes, which we interpret since the term waste in the Basel context is also used to refer to scrap. So plastic scrap has to be free, basically, or almost free, a term that has not been defined, from contamination and not mixed with other types of waste or scrap. And then there's the very small allowance for mixed plastics, which are for, PET, so resin code number 1, polyethylene. So it's not defined whether it's high density or low density. So, you know, resin codes 2 or 4, and then polypropylene resin code number 5. Also subject to certain terms in that bottle B3011 listing. So, but metrics, I think also, you know, so there's, in the Basel Convention context, countries could, you know, could potentially agree to define the terms in a certain way, but it's also up to the discretion of each individual country to make sort of their own interpretations, and they can always be stricter or, you know, just take a different interpretation. So I think it will be interesting to see how universal implementation is, or how it may vary country by country come January 1 or, you know, into next year.
Okay, we do have a few questions again on the application. And so this next one asks, how would this new export restriction impact the management of plastics from those that are used in electronics, such as computers?
Leah, you want to answer that?
Sure, yeah. So that's a good question. So, you know, the B311 listing, so the, you know, the plastic that wouldn't be subject to Basel requirements or the party non-party trade prohibition specifies that plastics must be non-halogenated. So to the extent that, you know, e-plastics or plastics used in electronics have, you know, halogenated compounds, so brominated flame retardants or other flame retardants that are halogenated, that would mean that those plastics wouldn't be considered B3011 plastics. So they would either be covered under the Y48, so the non-hazardous plastic listing in Basel Annex 2, or considered hazardous plastic waste in the Basel Annex 8, so the A3210 Basel code. So it could go either way. You know, the hazardous classification or the hazardous listing is for waste that contain an Annex 1 constituent, a hazardous constituent in Basel Annex 1, of which organohalogens are one, but then also exhibit a hazardous characteristic, which, you know, toxicity is one of many. You know, Rick mentioned several, but I would say, you know, toxicity would be the one of most relevance for plastics. So to the extent that countries consider, you know, e-plastics that contain halogenated compounds to be hazardous, they might classify it under that listing. Thank you for the question.
Okay. The next questioner states that there is a significant amount of plastic in mixed paper bales. And they note an Oregon's 2010 study found that our paper bales had about 1% plastic, and I've heard of even higher numbers elsewhere. They just note that this plastic seems to be just as harmful as the non-wanted plastics in the plastic bales. And they wondered, does Basel affect this plastic in exported paper bales?
So that's one question that we have, and that's a good question. I think you could ask that question about paper, which, you know, is a higher value, you know, recyclable certainly today. You could ask the same question for metals. I think it sort of remains to be seen what will happen to recyclables that are exported that contain both plastics and some other non-plastic scrap. It could be that they are controlled under the Y48, the non-hazardous plastic waste listing, that would be subject to Basel requirements. Or it could be if, you know, if the percentage is quite low, depending on how Basel parties, you know, come to terms with defining, you know, the terms, maybe that 1% contamination rate might be below a threshold. It really does remain to be seen what will happen to end-of-life materials that contain plastics and non-plastic materials. And if that person has, you know, additional follow-up questions, feel free to reach out.
Sure. There are some questions here about future actions or assistance as a result of these new rules. So one of the questioners asked, what will the U.S. be doing to improve local handling of plastic waste due to the lack of the ability to export now?
So that's a good question. Lee and I are international folks working on the import-export side. So I'm not as familiar with what's happening domestic in terms of recycling. You might want to check the American Recycling Strategy, which Leah had showed in one of her slides to get some insight on that. But that's outside the scope of what Leah and I do. I don't know. Leah, you don't know anything about that, do you?
No, I mean, I would point folks to the national strategy and, you know, there's America Recycling Summit coming up too, where there's opportunities for public participation. So there's, yeah, good resources, like you said, Rick, on our website about those efforts, which do include, you know, as, you know, some of the activities that have been identified as warranting, you know, further attention and, you know, dialogues with stakeholders. Are, you know, market development and infrastructure and processing capacity, and those are some of the issues that EPA is looking at in that context.
Okay, we had a few people again asking similar questions. If there's going to be any plans to expand the U.S. recycling capacity,
certainly our colleagues are hoping that that happens, and that's part of the it's part of the goals of the American Recyclers Summit that EPA is having in November, is to try and boost the recycling capacity in the U.S. So yeah, it's sort of in line with what Leah is saying. If you, you know, read the America Recycles Strategy and try and plug into the American Recycles Summit to get more insight into those kind of questions.
Okay, great. And the last content-related question that I have here is they want to know if you have any information on the U.S. end market and how it's going to be affected by these new international requirements. They go on to ask if you are anticipating any additional new manufacturing operations that might come on board in the next few years.
Well, certainly, you know, at EPA, we welcome, I mean, plastic scrap imports. I mean, we think the movement of plastic scrap just increases recycling overall. So, I mean, hopefully we're not going to see a decrease in, you know, plastic scrap imports for those who are getting, you know, material from outside the United States. I think some changes we're seeing, and we've seen this with the China National Sword Program, and we might see it with the Basel changes after January 1st, is that some of the Chinese companies are actually buying, they're getting recycling facilities here, and they're converting the plastic into pellets for shipping to Chinese manufacturers. So we know that the Chinese are buying more pellets from the U.S., and they're actually buying facilities that convert the plastic into pellets. So we might see further changes in that area as well. How it would affect, I don't know, U.S. manufacturing, I'm really not sure.
Okay. So at this time, I don't see any new questions. I've seen a number of people note that they had no additional questions, a few thank yous for the information. A few people have questions about copies of the presentation materials, which I'll be happy to talk about before we close out today. But I don't see any additional questions in the queue. So what I wanted to check with Leah and Rick to see if there were any final thoughts they wanted to leave with the audience, and if one or two last questions sneak in while you're sharing those thoughts, we'll try to get those in before we close things out. So Leah, any final thoughts you want to leave the audience with?
None from my end. Rick, do you have any?
Yeah, I would say it's, you know, like China National Sword in 2017. I think we're gonna see a dramatic change here after January 1st. And while there was confusion because with the China National Sword, because they made the changes without giving countries hardly any notice. I think in some ways what China did, while they didn't allow people much time, it was somewhat clear what China's requirements were, with like 0.5% contamination, that kind of thing. I think we're also going to see a dramatic shift in plastic scrap imports and exports in January, but it's going to be messier even than what happened with China, just because there's so many terms that haven't been defined. Countries are approaching it in different ways. We don't yet know how that is. And so I think all that's going to play out over the next year or two before we, I think, get into a more stable position. And it's just, there's going to be a lot of uncertainty for a couple of years.
All right. Thank you so much, Rick. So at this time, I still do not have any additional questions that have come into the queue, and we are coming right up on that scheduled end time of 3:30 p.m. Eastern. So with that, I'll just echo your thanks. I want to thank both you and Leah for joining us and sharing your expertise. I want to thank all of our participants who signed in and listened and shared their questions and comments. And I do want to confirm, for those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation material, we did email a PDF copy with the instructions to join today, but we'll also be reaching out. The organizers will be sending a follow-up email later this week, which will include links to the resources that were highlighted, as well as copies of the presentation material for your reference. So we do encourage you to keep your eyes peeled for that email. If you had a colleague who wasn't able to join us live, but they registered, we will also include them on that follow-up email. So anyone who signed up will get the resources from today's talk. And so with that, I'm seeing a lot of thank you messages that are just popping in. People appreciated the conversation, and they hope that there'll be more in the future. So I think we'll go ahead and officially conclude today's live broadcast. I want to thank everybody for joining us. And again, we'll shut down today's session. So this is the formal conclusion for today's live seminar.